I still get a sliver of excitement after watching a film that tells the stories of LGBTQ people. It's hard to describe what's contained in that excitement. It's something like a relief and recognition. Seeing the stories of people I can relate to or that I share community and history with and that are fully realized and not silenced, coded, or tainted with tragedy still doesn't cease to invigorate me. So, on this IMRU outing, I'm thrilled to present Pride on Screen.
Queer cinema is as old as the motion picture. In fact, Kino Video released several gay-themed silent films on DVD, the oldest of which was a German drama called Different from Others that first premiered in 1919. Although a plea for tolerance, its story of gay lovers, blackmail, and suicide only foreshadowed films to come. But those dire films had to wait a few years, because the 1930 enactment of the Motion Picture Production Code prohibited any depiction of, or inference to, sexual perversion. That's us. So for the next 30 years, you had to read between the lines to find us on screen. This provision wasn't lifted until October of 1961, just in time for a slew of gay-themed films without happy endings.
A taut, tense drama of the most untalked-about subject of our time.
First came a British import called Victim.
I want to know the truth. I want to know why he hanged himself.
He was being blackmailed.
That's why he stole?
Yes.
Someone found out he was a homosexual and blackmailed him.
That's it.
It takes two to make a reason for blackmail. Were you the other man? Were you?
A few months later, The Children's Hour debuted and played to shocked audiences. Yet The Children's Hour never mentioned the words gay or lesbian.
I lie in bed night after night praying that it isn't true. But I know about it now. It's there. I don't know how, I don't know why, but I did love you. I do love you.
This is the very first film you've ever seen in which there are lesbians.
Emmy-winning filmmaker Jane Anderson.
And then Shirley MacLaine hangs herself, and the last frame is her poor little feet swinging in the shadows of the attic. What kind of a message is that to give people? Shirley MacLaine killed herself because she realized she was a piece of filth.
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty, I can't stand it anymore.
And if the message wasn't clear enough, in 1962, Hollywood released the political parable, Advise and Consent.
He said to tell you, before you go on with the Leffingwell matter, you ought to remember what happened in Hawaii. And then he hung up. What happened in Hawaii, Brig?
What was the voice like?
It was Crawley. He made it sound like he knew some kind of nasty secret.
Is that Brig? What's the matter?
He's dead.
Brig?
In his office. Cut his throat.
And there was nothing gay about being gay in 1968's The Detective.
The thought of turning involuntarily into one of them frightened me and made me sick with anger.
I went down there. I had heard about the waterfront. People giggle and make jokes about it.
I had had only two experiences before, once in college, once in the army.
I thought I'd gotten it out of my life, but I hadn't. I looked at them. Was this what I was like? Oh, my God. Twisted faces. Outcasts, lives lived in shadows, always prey to a million dangers. People don't realize what we go through. I was raised in a family that would not even admit that there was such a thing as a homosexual in this world. And here I was, and I couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't stop.
By the end of the decade, it was so bad that even the characters within the film started to notice the pattern.
Well, I'll tell you something, Hallie. When the time comes, you won't have the guts. It's not always like it happens in plays. Not all faggots bump themselves off at the end of the story.
Luckily, times changed. In 1971, a year after The Boys in the Band, the British import Sunday Bloody Sunday brought the first passionate gay kiss to the screen. And although its significance is often overlooked, the 1972 film Cabaret reassured many a gay boy.
Doesn't my body drive you wild with desire? Well, doesn't it?
It's a very nice book.
Oh, do you really think so, darling? It does have a certain kind of style. I mean, look, it's very flat here. Not much hips. And, here.
It's a little early in the day for this sort of thing, isn't it?
Maybe you just don't sleep with girls. Oh. You don't. Well, listen. We're practically living together. So if you only like boys, I mean, I wouldn't dream of pestering you. Well, do you sleep with girls or don't you?
Sally, you don't ask questions like that.
I do.
We were fun in the 1970s. I've been making a man with blonde hair and a tan, and he's good for relieving my tension. I'm just a sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania. I'm just a sweet transvestite from transsexual Transylvania. The Rocky Horror Picture Show debuted in 1975 and The Ritz in 1976.
We're three caballeros, three gay caballeros. They say we are birds of a feather.
You mean to tell me that everybody here is,
We're happy amigos no matter where he goes.
Although it's hard to believe, both Cruising and The Village People's Can't Stop the Music came out only 4 months apart in 1980. That was a mixed message. But the first big gay films to actually put us front and center, to really explore our lives in a positive way, were both released in 1982. Personal Best and Making Love. Finally, there was pride on screen.
Okay, the truth is I have gotten into a lot of different scenes. I'm a writer. I have to open myself up to new things, expand my horizons. Bart? Zach?
Why don't you just say it?
I'm gay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Queer filmmakers have succeeded in creating a vibrant underground and alternative film scene. In the 90s, new queer cinema, led by Greg Araki, challenged established notions that queer legitimacy could only come through assimilation into mainstream heterosexual society. But judging a queer film's success isn't always about money made, as that requires crossover appeal. For instance, 2011's critically lauded Weekend barely broke $1 million at the box office, but made a huge impact on the queer in questioning who saw it. In fact, a reader's poll at the online site IndieWire, naming the 25 most important LGBT films, listed the top three as Weekend, Milk, and Brokeback Mountain. Steve Pride reports.
This week, there are two great examples of pride on screens in Southern California. The first is called Weekend. One of the best-reviewed gay films of the year comes from a British director primarily known for his 2009 documentary, Greek Pete. His latest offering is a scripted narrative film, but it still feels 100% grounded in reality.
My name is Andrew Haig, and I'm the director of Weekend. The film is a intimate look at a encounter between two men who meet on a Friday night and they spend a weekend together. And what starts as a one-night stand becomes something more resonant and important for them both. I'd seen a lot of films about gay people and gay guys getting together, and I wanted to do something that I felt reflected how I saw those relationships and what I think reflected being gay, and try and raise some different kind of issues and topics and try and kind of just do something a bit more honest, I think, than what I'd seen before. So I took a while writing the script and as it always does. And I spent probably about a year and a half trying different things out. And then no one wanted to put any money in it, so I put the script away and then took it out again about a year later and someone was interested. And then we got some money and then I did a bit of a rewrite. And then took it from there, really. Did some casting and worked on the script with the actors a little bit. My aim was always to try and make it feel as natural and real as possible. So at every stage it was, you know, does this feel real?
So what kind of stuff is it that you want me to say?
Anything you like. Just talk about last night, you know, what happened, what you wanted to happen. It's up to you, really.
Why?
Just because.
It's for an art project?
Yeah.
And you're just going to lie there and record me speaking?
Exactly.
And people can listen to it?
If you make the grade, yeah.
What sets this film apart from the pack?
There's a lot of good gay cinema out there, but there tends to be a lot of middle-of-the-road comedies, and there's a lot of still important issues and things to talk about. And there's lots of drama that can be made out of the kind of gay experience. And I just wanted to be quite subtle with it, I think, and just give the audience breathing space. I just want people to just feel like they've experienced this relationship that's developed on screen and that they can relate to that and they can see themselves in those characters and see themselves in some of those struggles that the characters are going through, whether in real life they're gay or they're straight or they're man or woman. I hope that still part of the struggles that the characters deal with will resonate with them, because it's not just about being gay. There's lots of things going on in the film and being gay is part of it. So I hope that people see different things in it, and that I think they do see different things in it. I think a gay audience responds to certain elements of it, a straight audience responds to other elements of it, and that's quite interesting to me, to see the different responses from different kind of people in different groups. And women again see something different in it, and you know, that was always my intention, was it to be, I suppose, more of a universal story, even though it's still very much about two gay guys. And that's obviously what it's about, but it is about more than that.
Weekend won the Grand Jury Prize at Outfest and the Audience Award at San Francisco's Frameline. And Weekend is the rarest of birds, a movie romance that rings true. Find more info on Weekend at weekend-film.com. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
...2008's Milk has brought in $54 million, won 2 Academy Awards, and was nominated for 6 more. Steve Pride reports.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you!
A movie about Harvey Milk has been in development at Warner Brothers since 1992. Some of Hollywood's best screenwriters have churned out over 20 scripts, and over the years, Daniel Day-Lewis, Kevin Kline, Richard Gere, Kevin Spacey, James Woods, Robin Williams, and even Steve Carell were all prospective Harvey Milks. So when I heard that Gus Van Sant was in San Francisco filming Milk with Sean Penn in the title role, I was surprised it wasn't connected to the Warner Brothers project.
By the time Lance brought the script over, which is a year and three quarters ago, almost 2 years ago, the Warner Brothers project had been in a state of somewhat dormancy, because it had been 16 or so years, and it had been in and out of different incarnations, and there was a new incarnation with Bryan Singer, but he was very busy, and it was just one of those projects, like in development type of projects, that I think it only affected us in the sense of, like, you know, if we start going on it, does that make the other projects start going too? Which I think existed for us. We never really knew what was going on. We were sort of in the dark. It was very spy versus spy.
It's been 5 years since I last spoke with outwriter Dustin Lance Black. But I suppose I don't have to ask what he's been up to in the meantime.
I started actually diving into the research and doing the work on the movie about 4 years ago. So that'd be about 2004. And I think that's right around the time that I had a friend introduce me to Cleve Jones. And I'd been wanting to tell the story for a long time, probably in some form or another, do something with the story or the message of the story since I heard it when I was like a teenage kid. Definitely after I came out, it became something I was focused on again. You know, it would just continually come up. I finally saw the documentary. That was really inspirational. And then in 2004, this buddy of mine said he wanted to do a rock opera about Cleve Jones, and I just had no idea that Cleve was even still alive. You know, so many of the leaders of that community, you know, didn't make it through the AIDS crisis in the 80s, especially those that lived in San Francisco, but Cleve did. And it didn't take more than a couple hours of hanging out with Cleve to know that there was a connection there, to hear like the vibrancy of the stories, to know that there was more to it than I'd ever heard. There's more to Harvey than I had read or seen. And thankfully, the guy had faith in me, you know, because there was no studio, there was no money. There was my charge card, and we would head up to San Francisco, and usually like an hour out of San Francisco, he'd call Beck's Motor Lodge and say, hey, we need a place to crash. You got a couple rooms, and we would we'd do an interview at a time. And then eventually I had met the folks, and I would just start going up my own a little bit and doing those interviews and digging and trying to find people who had either worked with him, or like Art Agnos, who had ran against him, people who he had dated or rubbed, you know, shoulders with in sort of a more personal way or a family way. And so, yeah, it's years.
And what was his biggest surprise about Harvey Milk?
The people I was interviewing were cautious at first. So you were getting little pieces of information. You were slowly kind of getting access to Harvey. So there weren't like any huge aha moments, because you were slowly adjusting to getting to know the man. Looking back, it's like, I don't think when I first heard his story that I would have ever assumed he was so bad at so much in his life. He had failed as a businessman. He couldn't figure out a job that he really cared about. He went from one occupation to the next. He, you know, he was a passionate boyfriend and very romantic, but so closeted that I think he, you know, in a way tortured these younger guys that he dated, who were kind of eager to come out and be more open. And, you know, it's basically just how flawed he was as a person. And I, you know, that's what you sort of don't know when you see some of the other stuff that's out there about him. And you kind of only get to find out if you really get to work and find things out firsthand.
Gus Van Sant filmed on location in San Francisco in the actual storefront that had been Harvey Milk's camera store in the 1970s.
When we first got to San Francisco, the city really hadn't had that many films come there, because it's really hard to sort of find places to put the vehicles and the hills. It's just really a pain, and I guess that's one of the main reasons, but the locations were really quite easy compared to stuff like that. The shop, it's a gift shop called Given, and they had a mural of Harvey inside the shop. So they were very into the legacy of the store, and they were just willing to let us close their shop down, which meant, you know, not being able to sell like their things, and let us move our set in there for, I think it was, 3 weeks. And that was relatively easy. The business association on the Castro was like very supportive. Most of the people on the street were really supportive of the project. And then the rest of the city was quite easy, yeah.
Emil Hirsch plays Cleve Jones.
First and foremost thing for me was just talking to Cleve Jones. And he was extraordinarily helpful. So what we did was, you know, we would just get together, we'd go eat, we'd go drive around San Francisco, he'd show me different locations and certain, you know, the symbols of where he was, you know, the places he used to hang out, you know. And it was really fascinating hearing his stories, because he has so many. And you hear some of these tales of, you know, mischief and mayhem that he kind of went through when he was younger, and you kind of get transported to that time and place. You know, he'll say, you see down that street, you know, I was leading a crowd of 10,000 screaming drag queens at midnight 30 years ago. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Playing a historical figure while they look on had its own challenges.
I mean, there was definitely an elevated pressure in a certain sense. Like, you know, I wasn't going to do anything that would make him, you know, look too, you know, I mean, I wasn't going to just pick my nose in a close-up or something like that, you know. And maybe that's a good thing that he was there. But at the same time, I always liked to do little things that would kind of drive him crazy. And, you know, I'd just be goofy, or I'd do a weird little movement, and I knew that it would bother him, you know. And he'd kind of try to say something, and I'd kind of say, okay, I'll stop it. But I'd keep doing it, you know, just because, you know, just to kind of toy with him a little bit. But that was good because, you know, he understood that, you know, he was like, listen, you know, you're doing an interpretation. You're not me. You know, it's your decision to do a lot of different things. And I went, cool. And I held him to it.
Don't go away. We'll be right back after this quick break.
Queer cinema coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. With the growth of the modern gay rights movement came LGBT film festivals. The first one was organized in 1970 by film historian Vito Russo to raise money for the Gay Activists Alliance. The oldest and largest of these festivals is the San Francisco International Lesbian and Gay Film Festival, which was established in 1977. At first, these films were all male-oriented. That all changed in 1994 with the scrappy lesbian film Go Fish. Today, there are over 150 LGBT film festivals worldwide, with most being annual events. They include Memphis's Twinkie Museum GLBT Film Festival, Calgary's Fairy Tales, and Richmond's own Real Pride Richmond. Nowadays, of course, some gay-themed films appear in local theaters, but seeing them at a gay film festival is a different experience altogether. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRAR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Brad Kuttner.
Hello, I'm Tab Hunter, and you are listening to IMRU Radio Magazine.
IMRU.
In the 1980s, Cleve Jones co-founded the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and conceived the AIDS Memorial Quilt. I asked Emil Hirsch if knowing what Cleve would later accomplish impacted his portrayal.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to play him to where you could see potential in him, but in the beginning, you don't necessarily have to see some saint. And, you know, Cleve says, he's like, listen, I'm not a saint, you know. Cleve's a, in many ways, you know, a regular guy, a very intelligent, funny, caring guy, but, you know, I didn't want to portray Cleve as a saint. If anything, I wanted to portray him as a rebel or a kind of a renegade, kind of.
In this scene from Milk, Harvey and his team have just moved in to his new office at City Hall.
Okay, first order of business to come out of this office is the citywide gay rights ordinance, just like the one that Anita shot down in Dade County. What do you think, Lotus Blossom?
I think it's good. It's not great.
Okay, so make it brilliant. We want Anita's attention here in San Francisco. I wanted to bring her fight to us. We need a unanimous vote. We need headlines.
Dan White is not going to vote for this.
Dan White will be fine. Dan White is just uneducated. We'll teach him.
Hey, Harv, committee meets at 9:30. Hey, you guys. Say, did you get the invitation to my son's christening? I invited a few of the other soups, too.
Oh, well, I'll be there.
Great. Thanks.
Are you going?
I would let him christen me if it means he's going to vote for the gay rights ordinance. We need allies.
I think he can
hear me. We need everyone.
Jesus.
I don't think he heard you.
Is it just me or is he cute?
There's an old saying that behind every successful man, there's a woman. In Harvey's case, it was a man named Scott Smith. In Milk, he's portrayed by the extraordinary actor James Franco.
It was pretty amazing just being able to shoot there what had been the center of the gay movement in the entire world. That was it. And to be doing it there, where it all happened, was very unique for me.
And Franco was not just awed by the memory of those brave activists.
Those people were like advisors on the movie, so they were there every day, like Cleve Jones and Danny Nicoletta and Frank Robinson. And I think they're all in the movie. They play little cameos, not themselves, but other roles. And so they were there every day. And it was a very unique, working on that set, especially in the camera shop on Castor Street. The film rented it and refurbished it to look like the old camera shop. And I remember when Frank Robinson, who was Harvey Milk's speechwriter, he also wrote the novel of The Towering Inferno, when he walked onto the set and, you know, I was sitting behind the desk and, you know, the other actors were there. And he, like, looked at me, and you could just see in his eyes, it was almost like he was being transported back. And from that moment on, he just called everybody by their character names, because those had been his friends. And It's not like he was a, you know, method actor or anything like that. It was just that he'd been, in a way, kind of transported back, and it was just almost like easier just to call everybody by their character names.
Diego Luna plays Harvey's last lover, Jack Lira.
I knew more about Castro area. I knew more about the movement in San Francisco, but I didn't know any of the specifics, you know. And I was there at a film festival showing my documentary, and I showed it at the Castro Theater. And I remember hearing the name, but as part of a bigger thing, you know. I never heard this story, and the first time I read the script, I was like, shocked. It's a story I felt guilty I didn't know, you know. It's an important story to know, basically. It's important to know there was a guy that changed the life of many in those years, you know. There's a feeling that you're doing an important story because it matters to people, you know, and we could feel that around the Castro area, you know, how this man changed the life of many and how this man made that place such a free place, a happy place to be in.
We all have our time machines. Some take us back. They're called memories. Some take us forward. They're called dreams. The film Milk offers a little of both. And according to Gus Van Sant, during filming, those lines began to blur.
There was a take where we were using sort of most of the room, but the camera was pointed in one direction, and there were three or four actors in the scene, and it's at night. I think it might have been the night where Anne Cronenberg like gets the endorsement. And there were some people sitting in the sofa, which was outside, and during one of the takes, just somebody walked in from outside and sat down in the sofa during the shot. And after the shot was over and we yelled cut, he got up and walked out. And so the actors were like, did you see that guy? And I said, who was it? I didn't see anybody. And they said, no, somebody walked in and sat down and walked out. And I was asking him like what he looked like, and they kept describing Harvey. And I thought, well, maybe that was like the ghost of Harvey just sort of walking in for a brief second.
And if it had been Harvey in the camera store, what would Dustin Lance Black have said to him?
Oh, I mean, to Harvey, you know, I would say thank you to Harvey. Harvey, I mean, I know it sounds corny, but when I first heard his story and I was a teenager, I was really lucky that we'd been transferred out of an army base in San Antonio, Texas, and transferred up to the Bay Area, and my mom had remarried, so we were out of the Mormon church, and I was sort of able to get out of this really conservative world that I had grown up in, and super fortunate to have heard the story of Harvey Milk at a theater that I was working at. And I was very closeted. I was sort of a dark kid, you know. I was, it's not easy keeping that secret, especially in a world where, you know, in the Mormon church, it is damnation. You are taught from an early age in a conservative environment that you're less than. And to hear about even the notion of an out gay man, like that was new. I didn't know what that was. I thought if you're gay, it's shameful, you hide it and you try to beat it down. And I didn't know that you could just sort of be out, much less be openly gay and elected to office and celebrated by people and remembered. I mean, this is, you know, a decade or more after he was assassinated that I was hearing his story, and I don't doubt that it kept me alive long enough to finally find a place where I was strong enough and comfortable enough to come out of the closet.
Harvey Milk was an ordinary man. He was not a saint. He was not a genius. His personal life was often in disarray. He died penniless, and yet, by his example and by his actions, he most certainly changed the world.
2005's Brokeback Mountain has grossed over $178 million to date and was nominated for 8 Oscars and won 3. Steve Pride reports.
Based on a short story by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Annie Prolu, the film version of Brokeback Mountain was directed by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Ang Lee from a screenplay by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Larry McMultrie and his longtime writing partner, Diana Asana. It's not just a landmark gay film. It's one of the most heart-wrenching love stories that I've ever seen. Set against the sweeping vistas of Wyoming and Texas, the film tells the story of two young men, a ranch hand and a rodeo cowboy, who meet in the summer of 1963 when they work as sheep herders up on Brokeback Mountain. Ennis Del Mar, played by Heath Ledger, and Jack Twist, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, become friends and then unexpectedly lovers. But at summer's end, the two must come down from Brokeback and part ways.
You gonna do this again next summer?
Well, maybe not.
Like I said, me and Alan was getting married in November. So, we're trying to get something on the ranch, I guess. And you?
I might go up to my daddy's place and give him a hand through the winter. I might be back. The army don't get me.
Well, I guess I'll see you around, huh?
Right.
Filmmaker Ang Lee is heterosexual, grew up in Taiwan, and was only 9 years old in 1963. So what drew him to this particular story?
Gay ranch hands in Wyoming, they're very far from me. But I think it touched that enigmatic subject of love, I think. And because the strange combination West macho Western and a gay love story, somehow. I think the unfamiliarity for me reach out very far in that mystery. And the emotion lands very hard, but the emotion is about missing, about something you don't get. I think that's very poignant, very profound. It's kind of existential to think that two characters spend 20 years trying to go back to where they started in the mountain, in a place that they hardly understand themselves. So that's a calling for me.
Remaining in Wyoming, Innes does wed his sweetheart Alma, has two daughters, and struggles to eke out a living. Jack, in Texas, catches the eye of a wealthy rodeo queen, gets a job working for her father, they have a son. 4 years pass. One day, Innes gets a postcard from Jack, who's en route to visit from Wyoming. When Jack arrives, it's clear that the passage of time has only strengthened their feelings. In the years that follow, Innes and Jack meet up several times annually. They struggle to keep their bond alive and secret from their wives.
You still go fishing with Jack Twist?
Not often.
No, I used to wonder how come you never brought any trouts home. You always said you caught plenty, and you know how me and the girls lack fish. So one night I got your Creole case open, not before you went on one of your little trips. Price tag still on it after 5 years. And I tied a note to the end of the line. It said, "Hello, Innes, bring some fish home. Love, Alma." And then you come back looking all perky. It said you caught a bunch of browns and you ate them up. Do you remember? I looked in that case first chance I got, and there was my note still tied there. That line hadn't touched water in its life.
That mean nothing, Alma.
Don't try and fool me no more, Innes. I know what it means. Jack Twist. Jack Nasty. You didn't go up there to fish.
Innes Del Mar's inability to move beyond the boundaries of expectations, dictated by time and community, brings tear-inducing poignancy to Brokeback Mountain. Actor Heath Ledger stuns in the stoic role. Despite Innes' taciturn nature, Ledger says he found things he admired in the man he played.
His potential, you know, he had great potential to love. And I think the one time you really see the potential is with his kids, his children, because that's the one form of love he's really allowed to express. It's not dangerous to him. And with his wife, it just wasn't really love. It was what he thought should be love. And it was a routine that he slipped into. Because it was conventional, it was traditional, and obviously his love for Jack was forbidden, and he hated himself for it. He punished himself for it, you know. Essentially, he was a homophobic man in love with another man, so that I guess I always had faith in the love within him a lot more than he did, and I think that's what all the characters I think found in him too was this the potential within this masculine figure to be kind of vulnerable. And
although Heath Ledger is receiving all the Oscar buzz, Jake Gyllenhaal's portrayal of the outgoing Jack Twist ranks among his best work, but it's not the role he thought he'd get.
I thought that Ang would want to cast me as Innes and Heath as Jack, just because I felt like Heath was more outgoing and you're used to Heath kind of being a kind of active, less passive presence, you know, and somewhere in my mind, naively, I guess I thought that. And when we were cast opposite what I thought, I realized that Aang recognized in both of us something that I don't think either of us saw necessarily. And that want to always kind of push forward and progress and change things was something in Jack that I felt like I really had too. and that the amount of words he says, I think it's sort of the same thing in a different way. They're like yin and yang, you know, and when they come together, I do think they make a circle. Heath and I talked a lot about it, and I find a lot of, just in Heath, him in his own nature, I feel like he carries his heart on his shoulder. You know, he's the kind of guy who's always protecting himself in different ways, but he's really a sensitive guy. And whether or not he's talking or not talking, I think you can sense that from him always. And I just was playing with that. Like, I saw that, and it was like a friendship that we had as actors that was somehow translated to in the movie.
One interesting thing about the release of Brokeback Mountain is that despite its pedigree, and despite being wonderful filmmaking, it's not really groundbreaking subject matter. We've had amazing gay love stories told before. But although this began as another potential low-budget gay indie, the casting of two of Hollywood's hottest young heterosexual stars pushed it into the headlines. And the press began to chant, "Aren't they brave?"
All we were doing was servicing a story.
Actor Jake Gyllenhaal.
You know what I think is really more courageous is people who are trying to be intimate in their real life and who are up against the real things. You know, we just were making a movie for 2 months where we played characters. And I think it's a time where more people are open to this than it might seem.
His co-star, Heath Ledger, concurs.
I think it's a bit silly. I think it's a bit obvious. And, you know, the whole that it's daring and that it's brave, and, you know, firefighters are daring and brave, you know. We're acting. It's like, I'm quite safe right now, you know. I'm not hurt. It didn't damage me. I'm alive. I didn't really have to be that brave. I was just doing something that, you know, I like to do. I was performing and portraying. It's in my interest. I don't know. I think it's a shame that it's built up too much. I think it shouldn't be such a big deal. But hopefully that's what this movie will do, is it'll slowly start to kind of open people's eyes and hearts and imagination. I think it's quite a shame that we live in a world where we have, and I think we're moving out of it slowly, where people are so eager to voice their opinions and disgust concerning the ways in which people choose to love one another. I don't know, it just doesn't make sense to me, and I think, I don't know. We certainly didn't go into this movie with any political intentions, like we don't want to change the world, but if it helps someone kind of accept other forms of love, then that's certainly not a bad thing.
Ironically, filmmaker Ang Lee would have had no problem casting gay actors.
I think if they're gay, it makes my job easier, and I'll welcome that, and the movie is a low-budget film, we don't need to please a whole lot of people. So a gay actor actually make my job easier. I would love to, but I gotta go with my best choice by the time I have to cast. I think Heath is a great anchorman for that Western thing, and Jake should be a romantic lead. So I just go for the best possible choice.
As a filmgoer and critic, I can't imagine a better cast or better storytelling. Brokeback Mountain is beautiful, moving and tragic.
What if you and me had a little ranch somewhere, a little cow and calf operation? It'd be a sweet life. I mean, hell, Lorraine's old man, you better give me a down payment to get lost. I mean, he more or less already said it.
No, I told you it ain't gonna be that way. You know, you got your wife and baby in Texas, and you know, I got my life in Riverton.
That's so. You and Alma, that's a life.
Oh, you shut up about Alma. This ain't her fault. The bottom line is, we're around each other, and this thing grabs hold of us again in the wrong place, in the wrong time.
And what would Heath Ledger like the audience to take away from the film?
For me, it's a story of how love transcends all. The environment you're born in, the opinions of generations before you, i.e. your family, your parents, your father, and how love is stronger than opinions that are installed in you as a child, and that it can break down those barriers, and just the power of love.
This has been a conversation with Ang Lee, Heath Ledger, and Jake Gyllenhaal. Brokeback Mountain is from Focus Features. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
He was a friend of mine. He was a friend of mine.
Every time I think of him, I just can't keep from crying. 'Cause he was a friend of mine. He died on the road. He died on the road. He just kept on moving, never reaped what he could sow.
Don't go away. We'll be right back after this quick break.
The Designer in Oz, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. In the 1939 film The Wizard of Oz, as Dorothy, the Scarecrow, and the Tin Man wind their way down the yellow brick road, they're confronted by a seemingly ferocious lion. But the character laments his true lack of courage, and with a limp wrist admits he's
just a dandelion.
It was a swipe at homosexuals, yet that very costume was designed by Adrian, Hollywood's premier costumer and an openly gay man. In fact, Adrian was head designer for all the extravaganza's costumes, including the Wicked Witch and the Munchkins. And who could forget Glinda, the Good Witch of the North, in her enchanting gown? Dorothy's ruby slippers were quite elaborate, and Adrian had four pairs made for filming. One pair was sold in year 2000 for $666,000. This Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Glenn Lash, in Philadelphia.
Hello, I'm Randall Kleiser, director of Grease, Blue Lagoon, White Fang, and It's My Party, and you are listening to IMRU Radio Magazine.
IMRU.
IMRU.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat. The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Dustin Lance Black won a Best Writing Oscar for Milk's original screenplay and doesn't mind being called a gay writer instead of a writer who's gay.
I'm Dustin Lance Black. I go by Lance because that's what my mom calls me. And I'm a film director. It's very important in my life because it's where my heart lies. So it does translate into my filmmaking. I think there were a lot of stories I was eager to tell early on that had to do with my sexuality, and because that's what was on my mind. I was in my early 20s. Sex is very important. Sex is still very important. But now different relationships catch my mind that aren't necessarily gay relationships. But you know what I always think? I think it's like, and I don't know if it's going to remain true for future generations. I almost hope it doesn't, because it means that there won't be the prejudice out there. But I think that because in my generation and previous generations, being gay and being sort of young and gay, you were very aware of the people around you. You're very aware of how you were behaving around people, because it was like a self-preservation thing. Like, you didn't want to be gay bashed. You didn't want to be hurt. You sort of wanted to sense how people were treating you, seeing you, all that sort of stuff. Plus, because, you know, you were going through some painful stuff, most likely, in adolescence, I think you're more empathetic. You sense other people's struggles. So I think in that way, gay people tend to make good storytellers. They're able to sort of sense what other people might be going through or feeling, or at least relate to them. And I think that's important. And I think that's something gay people bring to storytelling and filmmaking and art in general. I'm pretty thrilled about being gay and pretty excited about being openly gay, so I like boys, men, you know.
Horror Meister Clive Barker has written close to 40 movies. His films have few obviously gay characters, but there is still a queer sensibility to be found in all of his work.
I've had this argument back and forth over the years, and the smartest person I ever had the argument with was Gore Vidal. And Vidal, of course, passionately believes that there is no such thing as a gay sensibility, even though I think he is a perfect example of it at work. I think that if you are brought up with something so essential to you, your sexuality, forbidden you, unexpressed, undebated, uncelebrated, and you live your life having to find codes in the movies that surround you, in the general culture, in comic books or whatever, which allow you to find places of identification, then from a very early age, you start to shape a different sensibility to the straight person, your straight brother, let's say, who sees everywhere around him in the culture images which perfectly reflect his sensibility. I was born in 52, a long time before Stonewall, a long time before the Wolfden Report actually made gay alliances legal in England. So when I was brought up, it was a crime, and you were in jail for a long time, 20 years perhaps, for doing something that came naturally to you. If you define yourself, therefore, as unnatural from a very early age, even if you don't quite understand the vocabulary, if you define yourself as an outsider, because really you have no choice but to define yourself as an outsider. Everybody else has defined you that way. If you learn to be secretive, because it's easier to be secretive than to be open and honest, if you start to look around at the culture with a different kind of eye, an eye which is looking constantly for things which signal that there are people out there who are like you. I think if you're looking around for all those things and trying to shape up an opinion of yourself based upon buried clues around you in the culture, all of those things and a thousand others help you shape a different kind of sensibility to your straight sibling. If you're an artist and as an adult you start to use the feelings that you developed as a child in your art, and every artist does that, every artist churns over these early feelings, then I think what you have is art which is shaped by gay sensibility. And if I take a long time to make the argument, it's because I'm a little tired of the weary throwaway line that there is no such thing as the gay sensibility. I think it just needs to be argued cogently once and left alone. Of course there is such a thing as the gay sensibility. Of course gay men and women think in some fundamental ways differently from straights. It is not just about what we do in bed. It is about the echoes in the culture of who we are or who we aren't. And it's how we deal with those things. It's the stories we tell to one another. It's the stories we tell to ourselves, which make us feel whole and healed. It's all part of that sensibility.
Paul Kolickman was the producer of Gods and Monsters and is president of the Here TV cable channel. He thinks queer filmmakers have a lot more to accomplish.
We haven't normalized gayness yet. It needs not to be the center of the movie. It's all about, we're gay. It's a film about being gay and gay people doing gay things. It's like, no. You're a cop, but you happen to be gay, but you're also on the trail of a serial killer. We all have hundreds of gay friends. Most of our friends do real jobs. They do something real. They're doctors, they're lawyers, they're accountants. They live in the real world. But we don't get to see people in the real world. We see people in this kind of altered gay universe through most film. I would say idealized, but I'm not quite sure whose ideal it is, but certainly altered state of existence.
Sasha Rice, the director of Mango Kiss, isn't sure Hollywood is to blame for the scarcity of great lesbian films.
The statistics show that gay men have more disposable income than lesbians, and so there's that. And then also, gay men statistically go see movies more than lesbians, so there's that. To really kind of make money at the box office, even if you're just doing home box office, you need a theatrical to kind of make that money. And the gay men go out and they see the movies, and the lesbians, I think, tend to stay home. And shame on you. You got to get out there and support it.
And the final word goes to filmmaker John Waters, who believes that queer film and the gay community are in pretty good shape.
I think times have gotten more censorious, but at the same time, I think we're the freest we've ever been. I mean, who ever would imagine that gay marriage could have been legal anywhere when you went to jail for being gay when I was in high school? Words that Lenny Bruce went to jail about are now routinely on sitcoms. So a lot has happened good. A lot of things have changed. It's the freest it's ever been. All my movies have the same message. Mind your own business. Let other people live. And if you have something that's strange that society doesn't approve of, you can always, once you make friends with that neuroses, exaggerate it, turn it into a style, and win.
More recent films demonstrating pride on screen were Moonlight and Call Me By Your Name. Steve Pride caught up with the book's author, Andre Aciman.
Are you stunned by the success of the film?
Totally stunned. I never expected it. I never thought it would happen. And even when they told me they were making a movie, I still didn't believe it was going to happen.
What do you think of the movie as opposed to the vision you had in your head as an author? I know it's difficult to say, oh, that's not how I saw it.
Yeah, because I saw it happening on the shore of Italy. And this happens in a landlocked area near Milan. But it doesn't matter. I mean, I was very happy with the film. The house that I imagined was a different house. This house is absolutely the most fitting house that I could ever have pictured. So it has given me images that I never had as a writer.
Gay men especially have like embraced this. At a function I was at, someone mentioned that they thought it was a good film, but, and the second they say but, there was almost like boos. People wanted to rip them apart. They're so taken by this film, they're obsessed with it, in fact.
Everybody's obsessed by it, and I think most people see it many, many times, and they read the book many times, which is something that I never do, but apparently it has hit a particular kind of mark and made a mark on people's lives, and I still have a hard time figuring out what precisely it is. In most cases, it's the love that could have been and never happened, or it's the love that many people who are so young hope to find in their lives.
You're a heterosexual man. I know this is a cliche question now. You're probably thinking it a lot. Where did this come from?
I don't know. I have no idea where it came from. But once I got started on the gay theme, I couldn't let it go. And it was totally, totally riveting and exciting. I fell in love with the characters. I fell in love with each one, with their love, with everything. And clearly, obviously, something is going on inside of me that goes in that direction. But I have no idea where it came from.
The speech that the father makes at the end of the film was almost word for word from the book.
Yes, and that was extremely gratifying for my vanity. But I think that the speech, the way it was delivered, was... I never read the speech again when I give a public reading because it's so well done by Michael Stuhlbarg that I will not touch it again. It is the best thing, I think, besides Timothy at the very end, the best thing of the film.
I almost walked out at the end without, and I thought, they're still going.
Yes, that is probably the most magical moment and most enchanting and heartbreaking moment is that you see the face and you see the face and you see the face and you don't think much about it until suddenly you see the credits and you realize that, oh my God, the film is over. This story is over. It's finished. It's ended. This is very sad. And that's exactly how I felt, and I think most people feel more poignantly, because I'm the author, I know how the story ends, but most people are surprised and almost sort of smitten by the whole experience of, not now, I could use another 5 minutes of this film, this story.
Actually, it goes on. There's a sequel going to be filmed, correct?
They're talking about a sequel. They're talking about many sequels, because they want to trace the sort of the trajectory of their lives through the years, very much the way that the Truffaut did with Antoine Doinel, and that's Luca Guadagnino's project. Whether it comes about or not, I don't know. We discuss possible sort of plot lines.
But they didn't use the whole book, so there's still more story in your book they can tell.
There is more. I mean, I think half of the book was left out. But it's not germane to the actual story because the rest is just after love or after years. And I don't think that there's a plot there, really, to be honest. I mean, there's a trip to Rome, but the trip to Rome is just a long, Fellini-esque sort of adventure. But there's nothing going on between the two that is any different from what happened before.
Is there any moment in the film when you're watching it that you like exclaim to yourself, that's it, they got that moment so right?
Oh, that happened many, many times. When he goes into the bedroom and sort of tries the bathing suit, that was not exactly as in the book, but that's the same idea. And finally, when they both speak about the possibility of something happening between them, though they do not name it, nevertheless, it's so oblique and yet at the same time so clear. That was perfect. And it was right out of the book.
I'm going to imagine that when you go out, people must give you peaches.
All the time. I think the peach has become the equivalent of Proust's Madeleine. People always come up and give me peaches. They give me ceramic peaches. They give me some images of peaches that they've drawn on the internet. I get peaches all the time. It's a token of affection now.
What do you hope people take away from your book and the movie?
I want them to experience love, of course. I want them to say, this is what love is. But I also want them, if there is a message, and I'm always hesitant to suggest that there is one, is not just of tolerance, but I hope that parent-child relationships be improved significantly so that if a child is gay, he should see that there's a model out there, there's a solution out there, and that a father, if he has a son who is gay, he should absolutely make it possible for the son to speak if the son is reluctant to. Basically, it's be open, address the issue, it's okay now.
And I know you did film festivals a little bit. What was the feedback you got from people?
A lot of people say that it changed their lives, and I'm such a jerk that I always say, how did it do that? And it turns out that they don't know, they don't have an answer.
There's a reason why representation matters has long been a rallying cry for the LGBTQ community. From books to television to movies, the stories we consume have the power to shape how we see other people and ourselves. So when a film comes along that manages to really nail the queer experience, we as a community hold on tight to our favorites. We've given you a peek at three films, but maybe something different speaks to you. A Single Man, God's Own Country, Carol, Dallas Buyers Club, or even Boys Don't Cry. Whatever moves you from subtle and quiet to political and groundbreaking.